Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. When the Buddha is given a, or been, when the Buddha is asked to summarize his teaching and sort of explain it in as succinct a way as possible, one of the ways he does that was with the phrase "Sambe Dhamma Nalang Abhinive Saya," which is, all dhammas are not to be clung to, or all dhammas are not to be adhered to. So that this is where the perspective of, say, you know, the importance of letting go comes from. The Buddha's own kind of synopsis of the teaching. And so many of the, say, contemporary teachers, particularly in the forest tradition, put a lot of emphasis on the aspect of letting go, of relinquishing, not clinging to things, not adhering, not sticking. So in order to facilitate that tendency with or the ability to really let go, to put things down, this is where the reflection and investigation of dukkha is so important. That investigation of the aspects of that are suffering or unsatisfying or really leading to discontent. So that it's important to recognize that it's not a value judgment on experience, but it's investigating things in a particular way that will help us to let go, help us to really not cling, not stick. Because it's that, you know, the sticky nature of existence that keeps us coming back to, you know, the hope of finding a desire that's finally going to gratify or satisfy, or to find an experience that is going to be stable and certain for us. You know, and there's always the hope. You know, despite the evidence that keeps piling up, as human beings, we're astoundingly resilient and you know, willing to establish hope in of something truly satisfying. It's like that well known Nasruddin story when Nasruddin goes off traveling to to, he leaves his home country of Persia and goes off to India, buys the cheapest fruits available in the market. And of course, they're chilies. And he's sitting there eating the chilies. And, of course, the tears are pouring down his face, and he's all flushed, and it's obviously very painful. And finally somebody comes up and just is astounded, and, what are you doing? And he says, I'm waiting for the sweet one. And this. And, the hope is always there. And it's a statement of the human propensity to continually be willing to disregard the evidence and work according to our desires, our attachments, our clinging. Now we, in the same way that it doesn't matter how many times we've got angry, irritated, upset at other people, other situations, and one would think one would have recognized after 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years of using anger and aversion and irritation as an option, and seeing that actually nothing, any good, useful, harmonious, peaceful has ever come from it. But we continue to exercise that option. The evidence is not enough. Because we don't really we don't pay attention to the dukkha involved in it. We don't pay attention to the unsatisfactoriness. We keep working from a position of desire, of hope, of expectation. So the necessity of really bringing dukkha as a noble truth into contemplate, to investigate, and to really teach ourselves. again, this isn't a value judgment of everything is miserable, because that comes from a place of aversion as well. But it's really looking at it in that sense of there is this consistent element of of suffering or of stress or of incompletion that really needs to be attended to, so that we don't hold so tightly, we don't stick to things so much. It's also important to investigate how the Buddha explains dukkha, because there's three different aspects of dukkha. And the first one is dukkha. I mean, this is kind of painful dukkha, the dukkha of old age, sickness, death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. The sort of the physical limitations of a body, the emotional realm that keeps going back to the pain of experiencing the unpleasant, the unwanted, or not getting what we want, pain of sort of grief that comes from loss. So those are there's sort of a huge realm of the opportunities for dukkha arising. But there's also on a deeper level, a more refined level, there's what the Buddha points to as viparinama dukkha. And that's the suffering that arises from separation from the pleasant, so that the whether it's an experience, person, we create attachment, we create a sense of a very strong connection and dependence on that person or situation for our happiness, and then there's separation, and the whether it's for a shorter or longer period or however the separation occurs, then that is it's painful. So that, or even because that happy, pleasant feeling, warmth, is something that we just very naturally we crave, we seek. And within that, there's also the, because it doesn't even have to take place, and we already begin to fear separation, so that we, we create dukkha within that, just through fear of separation. So that fear of separation, the fear of change. Even when everything is going absolutely perfectly, and then the mind starts to worry and wonder, when's the crash going to come? When's the disappointment going to come? And it's just it creeps in. Dukkha creeps in. So that the necessity of being able to recognize that all dhammas, all things are not to be clung to, not to be held to. The pleasant is one can't just try to prop up the pleasant. We can't do it anyway, but there's we sometimes labor under the delusion that we can or could. If we could do that, that would be great. Because it has its own kind of aspect of suffering to it. And then the last kind of dukkha that the Buddha points to is sankhara dukkha. I should also say, just because even the, like viparinama dukkha, the dukkha of separation, is even when we're, say, like with the meditation, that our meditation is going really good. Mind's becoming really peaceful. Mind's becoming really settled. And the and then that separation from kind of peaceful or blissful states of concentration. That's in the reading that we had yesterday. That's an incident that Ajahn Mahabua talks about, and his he always comes back to it. Just when he first started meditating, and finally achieving states of samadhi and concentration, and the mind being extraordinarily bright and happy and blissful, and then not being able to replicate that. And the tremendous sense of that was more suffering than anything he'd ever experienced before. The frustration of being separated from the most sublime thing he'd ever experienced. And he said, because there's the attachment there, the clinging. The sankhara dukkha, the dukkha of things being of a compounded nature, so that what that's pointing to is the kind of in whatever thing or experience, because it's of a compounded nature, and each element that makes up that composition is impermanent and fundamentally unstable, then the nature of any experience is always there's a certain element of it being at odds with each other, so that there's this unstable nature. So that in order to just say like our bodies, their composition of all sort of different elements, and so just the four basic elements, four primary elements, and they're being sort of the body is the cells are being built up and breaking down all at the same time. So that there's this constant change and instability that's taking place, and it can be on things that, you know, on a level that we don't really recognize or notice, but in the end, nothing has a real consistent, stable nature, you know, whether it's on the material level, and things that look extraordinarily permanent, but there's this constant change taking place, constant these conditions that brought about its coming into being are working in a dynamic process that are also leading to its dissolution or change, its instability. And particularly with the mind, or when we have our relationships with other people, because it also, it comes back to how we you know, even our relationships with people in the world around us are, I mean, they're not absolutely objective things. It's completely about the subjective nature of our own perceptions and how we relate and how we the values we have, the perceptions that we have, and those are always subject to change. What somebody does one day can be a source of great affection, and after they've been doing it for a while, it can be a source of great irritation and aversion. It's how we perceive it. And we can inflate it or fixate on it, and that conditions any relationship with other beings or with the world around us is always conditioned by our own, what's going on in our own mind. So externally, everything is bound by conditions that are, let's say, sankharas, they're complex compositions, and then internally, how we experience it is also this complex composition. So there's an instability that is inherent within that, and we don't really pay much attention to it, and we don't really want to know about it, because what we want is we want to be happy and secure and comfortable. So of course that's where we relate to that wish, that fundamental desire, with more desires and attachments, and of course with basic delusion. So the Buddha is trying to get us to put this very clearly on the screen, so that we're willing to come back to a place of recognizing sambhaya dhamma nalanga piniwesaya. All things are not to be adhered to, not to be clung to. So that the viewing of the world around us, or the viewing of ourselves, recognizing this nature of dukkha, of unsatisfactoriness, of difficulty, of stress. So that is, one is not putting that into that light in order to create more stress and suffering. One's doing it in order to turn to the ability that the mind has. I mean, we have the ability of viewing things through delusion and attachment, clinging, and compound the situation and create more suffering, but we also have the ability to view it through the lens of mindfulness and wisdom, of satipanya. We have that opportunity to exercise discernment and then apply the mind in a way of relinquishment, of letting go, of seeing clearly. And that leads to a great sense of clarity and peace. Of course, that's where our sort of true happiness and well-being comes from. It's not from getting things as we want it and propping up things in a way that we hope they would be, but by really letting go, being able to see things clearly. And again, whether it's the world around us or internally our own perception of ourselves, coming back to that recognition of suffering and turning to relinquishment. Okay, this is why the the Buddha emphasizes the quality of letting go. And honing back in on the, you know, what we, you know, what is it that creates the holding? And it's our sense of self, sense of the experiencer, that self, that sense of self nature. And say when we chant the Dhammacakka Sutta, or chant the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, the sutta on the characteristics of not self, there's a phrase that is that comes up that we chant through that and through the sutta. And, you know, ne tan mama ne so hamasami, that me so atati, and that this is not mine. This is not me or I, and this is not myself. And particularly in reference to body, feeling, perception, mental formations, consciousness. And this is, because that's where we, that's the, as to how the Buddha delineates it, you know, this is the basic foundation of our, the building blocks of our world, of our, and sense of who we are. We experience, we have the body, we have the feelings, pleasant, painful, neutral, perceptions, sense of giving meaning to things, and memory, mental formations, all of the wholesome or unwholesome ways of directing the mind and creating mental states, and consciousness, the ability to know through the sense doors. And just through that is the, those are the building blocks of our sense of who we are and what the world is around us. And that seeing that those are, any one of those are not individually, or collectively able to encapsulate, any of that experience. That's all it is just, It's just body. Or it's just a feeling. The feeling arises and it passes away. The perception, the memory, it's there. It arises, it ceases. We don't have to put interpret it through the lens of this is mine, this is my experience of pleasure, I want it to be there, this is my suffering. And then either agonize over it or identify with it or be fascinated by its uniqueness. I am a unique one, a human being defined by my suffering. It's in the end, that's what that's basically what we spend our time doing. Mental formations, the same consciousness, and just saying that's all it is. It's that experience of knowing a sense object, sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, mental object. We're conscious of it, and it arises and it ceases. So it's actually a great mantra to to use in meditation. This is not mine. This is not I. This is not myself. You know, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, whether it's wanted, unwanted, whatever the degree of refinement or coarseness of the experience or the, this is not mine, this is not I, this is not myself. And you're not trying to convince yourself of it, but what you're doing is trying to bring up a perspective again so that you can not be getting caught in the clinging, the adhering, the sticking, so that the mind is much more able to turn to relinquishment and letting go. And as we do this and attend to the letting go, attend to the qualities of non-attachment, there's a tendency sometimes to think that somehow it's going to leave one a diminished human being, or functioning on the level of a sort of a cold neutrality that doesn't take any interest in anything. But when we one looks at the examples of sort of real human beings, so whether it's historically, and certainly the Buddha is the greatest example, in that the kind of he wouldn't. Say somebody would not be remembered for over 2,500 years if they didn't have made a positive impression on somebody's mind. And just as is the impact of the Buddha in an extraordinarily positive way that people wanted to emulate from that time through to this time, over 2,500 years. And that's there are qualities that the Buddha obviously embodied that have inspired successive generations. To the present time, Ajahn Chah is, of course, our direct teacher or example. And the tremendous impact that he's made because of the kind of life that he's breathed into these teachings. And for him, the ability to let go really. One sees that what it gives you is a opportunity to be at the center of experience and not be shaken or moved. It was always wonderful to watch Ajahn Chah receiving people and giving advice, and it would. Because you'd never know what he was going to say or do. Not in an erratic sense, but in the sense that he was always attuned to how to help a person, how to help a situation, how to try to facilitate their waking up. And that it was, this afternoon I went up to pay respects to this senior monk who's visiting KPY, and I was relating to him about Ajahn Chah. He actually mentioned himself that he really enjoys listening to Ajahn Chah's teachings, and that he seemed to have such both wisdom as well as loving kindness. And that was very much the case, that this tremendous loving kindness that drew people into him, and I related to him that it was the abbot of Wat Bopong right now, Ajahn Chah's monastery, was saying, "Oh yeah, you know, Ajahn Chah had tremendous loving kindness," and said, "but it drew so many people to him." And he said, "But it's also that's pretty tiring." He says, "Okay." He said, I'm working more on equanimity." This is Ajahn Liam. But in his own way, even though Ajahn Liam says that, in his own way, he has his own sort of way of conveying quality of loving kindness or openness or support for others, because he's in the middle of this position of responsibility, and he's just so steady, so that he's a support and an anchor for so many people, both monastics and lay people, in the there must be 200-300 branch monasteries of Ajahn Chah's now, just in Thailand. And of course, whenever anything happens or some difficulty or some problem, then they run to Ajahn Liam. He's expected to fix it or support them or do something. And he's always there for people. So that their sense of the letting go is not putting one into a diminished position or a so sort of coldly aloof that one is not engaged, but one's able to engage in a way that's very 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 positive, because it's tempered by wisdom and discernment. It reminds me of a story that I read or an incident where a Christian context where a seminary, the old abbot of a monastery was speaking with a large group of young people, and talking about kind of monastic vocation, and one of the young people asks this old abbot, "If you had the opportunity to make the choice again, would you do it? Would you choose, to the monastic vocation? And he was very silent, and of course that put the sense of everybody on the edge of their seat, expectation of what he was going to say. And he said, "Yes, I would certainly do it again, make the same choice." He said, "But I think I would be more generous." And he explained that the tendency of the both in particular in the Christian tradition, of course they do a lot of study first, and they said the nature of sort of the education and training is to train us to be have an intellectual rigor that can easily lead to a sense of intolerance or unwillingness to accept the foibles of others. So then, and if I were able to do it all again, I would begin with being a lot more generous, being a lot more kind. And that's I think the fruits of spiritual practice, the fruits of seeing clearly, and the fruits of letting go, that kind of illustrates that perspective. In the end, there's this commitment to relinquishment, but the natural fruits of that is also a generosity of heart and a kindness, a willingness to give and share. So that as we begin and continue our practice, to bring that into perspective also, to focus on that and to allow it to come forth. We contemplate the nature of the body, the nature of the mind. We turn to these themes of dukkha, anicca, dukkha, anatta, looking at impermanence, suffering, non-self. And it's not to turn away from things in the sense of pushing away, but looking at things closely so that we can really put our desires, attachments, our aversions and delusions, we can really see them clearly and put them down. And say, when all things are not, when the Buddha says, Sambe dhamma nalangap, anyway, sorry, all things are not to be clung to. It's really coming back to that internal point of our own greed, hatred, delusion, our own sort of ways that we entangle ourselves in complication, and really being able to put that down, seeing through it. And when we're able to put that down, what naturally comes forth from that is a far more generous quality of a being, far more kind quality of being, far more clear and wise being arises from that, not because we're trying to make ourselves that way or become that way or force ourselves into being sort of wise beings, but that is just, that's its nature. That being willing to look at those things that we tend to want to skip over. Dukkha. We want to skip over it. Who wants to look at those aspects of unsatisfactoriness? But it's exactly what is necessary. And it takes a certain, a certain willingness and resilience, wisdom, discernment to do that. So to bring up these themes and to explore them, really work with them. So I'll offer that for reflection this evening.
Mandalayam dhamma shataya sadhukaram.